Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the white supremacist group, which made donations to Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, and Scott Walker, and according to Dylann Roof's manifesto, inspired the AME church shooter's newfound racism. James Corcoran, professor in the Department of Communications at Simmons College and author of Bitter Harvest, The Birth of Paramilitary Terrorism in the Heartland, and co-author with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Morris Dees of Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat, joins us to discuss how the Council of Conservative Citizens shed the robes of the KKK and began wearing suits and ties, and courted Republican politicians who so far have escaped responsibility for the GOP's pervasive use of coded racist dog whistle politics used to win back the Senate for the Republicans in 2014. And then we'll speak to a former U.S. trade negotiator in the Clinton administration, Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years in the U.S. Senate as counsel to the majority leader. We'll discuss the Senate's narrow passage of trade promotion authority for President Obama to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership without the Workers' Assistance Program, the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance. We'll try to find out why the president went against 80 to 90% of his own party and had to side with the Republicans to get fast-track approval for the TPP. Then finally, we'll look into the possible humanitarian catastrophe if the Dominican Republic goes ahead with its plan to evict hundreds of thousands of Haitians born in the country who have been denied citizenship rights since birth. Brian Concannon, the executive director and founder of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, joins us to discuss the fate of these stateless people who, if deported, will only add to Haiti's many problems. And joining us now is James Corcoran, who is a former journalist and now professor in the Department of Communications at Simmons College. He has written extensively on domestic terrorism, including his award-winning book, Bitter Harvest, The Birth of Paramilitary Terrorism in the Heartland, which examines the rise of the anti-tax movement in rural America embodied by extremist groups such as the Posse Comitatus and Sovereign Citizens. He also co-wrote with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Morris Dees, Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat, which traced the growth and impact of hate groups, militias, and racist demagogues in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombings. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Corcoran.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And do you accept my premise, and certainly something I feel is pretty manifest and evident, that the Republican Party has largely dodged its responsibility for its dog whistle politics and for riling up racist white voters? I mean, that's how they won back the Senate, particularly in key states, states where they in Arkansas and in Louisiana, where there was no mention made of the Democratic opponents to their senators. Every time they showed a picture of their candidate, instead of showing the Democrat they were running against, they showed the black man Obama, and as you know, the Republicans have been disgustingly racist in their attacks on Obama. So, to some extent, the fact that a number of these presidential candidates—Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, and Scott Walker—have taken money from this racist organization that's, you know, as I mentioned, have shed the robes of the KKK and began wearing suits and ties, the Council on Conservative Citizens. And, of course, they pledged to give their money back or have it donated directly to the AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Is that an indication that maybe there will be some responsibility for dog whistle politics in American politics?
Well, I don't know, Ian. I mean, we've had this happen before, where in the 90s, you know, Trent Lott, then head of the Senate, and Bob Barr, who was a representative with Georgia, you know, they were called out for, you know, going before the CCC and speaking to them, and even at that time, the Republican Party chairman, following the the outcry of this action, you know, urged its members to, or urged Republicans to withdraw from the CCC. But, you know, that was, what, 15 years ago, and here we are again, going back around.
Well, in his manifesto, Dylann Roof, who murdered the nine worshippers in the AME church in Charleston, he gives credit to the Council on Conservative Citizens for waking him up into this racist world that he embraced, that led to the shooting. So,
the thing is it is a racist organization, and it wouldn't have been hard for Trent Lott and Bob Barr back in 1998. To find that out, of course, when they got called on it, they said they didn't know what the organization was all about. And I'm sure we're hearing the same thing from, you know, the Walkers, the Cruises, and the rest of them, saying, well, we didn't, you know what their real history is. It doesn't take much. I mean, you check their websites, it's pretty blatant. And these folks... don't believe in any kind of mixing of the races. In fact, they often say that God is the true racist because he separated, the races, and he wants us separate. And so it's pretty clear where they stand. It's pretty crude where, their racism and white supremacy views.
So, given that these people used to be in the Democratic Party, the Dixiecrats, and when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1965, he said, you know, the Democratic Party is going to now lose the South. And with the Nixon Southern strategy, he was proven correct. And now the Republican Party has largely become a Southern party, or at least it's dominated by the South. I guess are we still dealing with the vestiges of the Confederacy and the Civil War here? Is this something that is so deeply ingrained in the political DNA of the South that it's just going to live on in this kind of toxic form and occasionally rear its ugly head as a bunch of people get massacred?
Well, I think, you know... there will be that tipping point, I believe, Ian. I don't know that we're there yet, but, I mean, you had people in South Carolina, I mean, the move to, take down the flag. And even in Mississippi now, where they're, you know, acting about possibly changing their state flag, taking the battle flag of the Confederacy, you know, out, that element out. But are these things going to stop anytime soon? I don't think so. I mean, what's interesting too, Ian, I mean, we were warned about this in 2009 after Obama's election by Homeland Security. They predicted in a report that, you know, right-wing extremism is going to multiply and going to increase and could, as to quote the report, be more severe than we've ever experienced.
Right, I don't mean to interject, James, but at that time that report was released by Homeland Security, Republican congressmen and senators went crazy.
Bingo. Boehner called the report offensive and unacceptable, and, you know, that report was pulled. I mean, it just speaks to, you know, they've got to wake up to this. They can't continue to pay this lip service and, provide this sympathetic ear to these people. I mean, we had this, a month ago in Texas, where you had the governor, you know, listening to these people about the, this military
exercise,
exercise that they were going to have. And saying that he wanted, you know, the Texas National Guard to keep an eye on the U.S. military in case of possible takeover or some such nonsense. I mean, we're in, you know, tinfoil hat areas, and yet here they are paying lip service to these guys. I mean, not just paying lip service, but indicating to them that, yeah, your ideas are legit.
And taking $56,000 from the president of the CCC.
Yeah. And if you're telling these people that their views, which are so off the chart, are actually legitimate, I mean, you're giving them the right to take whatever steps they feel is necessary. You know, if they come to believe that, Jesus, we're not doing enough, then we have to take, you know, it upon ourselves. I mean, I think, you know, this idea that the federal government isn't to be trusted, you know, I mean, in a way that could lead to violence. I mean, you know, there should be people stepping up and saying, no, this is just nonsense. You know, this is military exercises. We've done this for years and years and years. You know, we're just not going to pay any attention to this, or we're not going to accept this.
Well, this, of course, the manifesto that Dylann Roof wrote, where he said, the first website I came to was the Council on Conservative Citizens. There were pages upon pages of these brutal black-on-white murders. I was in disbelief. Yep. At this moment, I realized that something was very wrong. Well, of course, it was very wrong. The information is complete nonsense.
Right.
A 2014 report by the Sentencing Project found that the media has overreported crimes with black offenders and white victims, but it is not a real phenomenon. It is a racist fantasy.
Right.
As is the racist fantasy that he apparently spouted out before he shot those people in the church, that you're raping our women and taking over the country. I haven't noticed that African Americans are taking over the country. Have you? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, you know, it's more of that same, you know, stuff from, you know, the extreme right, it's just the extremist element. They feel that they've lost something. They feel like, you know, they're not in control any longer.
Right, but we know that. We know that they feel that way. But my problem is that the Republican Party stirs that pot and preys upon that fear and uses coded racist messages to say, vote for us and we're going to take care of your interests.
Exactly.
Because you know, the 47% of freeloaders are the reason why the Democratic Party throws money at them to bribe them to get their votes. That was the message that Mitt Romney put out. That apparently is what a lot of people believe.
Yeah, I mean, and there are, I wouldn't say a lot of people, but there's a, you know, a strong subset of people who believe that, and they are, you know, if you listen or read the, you know, what political analysts say, you know, I mean, the Republican primary is, you know, controlled by the most conservative, and you have these most conservative beliefs, which, you know, include this nonsense, this tripe, this, you know, material that's included on the CCC's website. And, yeah, it's like if you stand up to that, you know, something, you're not going to get the votes you need. And I don't, for the life of me, Ian, I don't understand that philosophy where I go so far to the right that I accept this nonsense, or I at least pay lip service to it, and then somehow I'm going to come back and be, you know, a rational person in the, general election. But that seems to be the idea that, you know, look at the way these guys acted when this first happened. None of them could say this was a racist hate crime. You know, Jeb Bush said, I don't know what's in the guy's, you know, heart. Well, it was pretty clear. And I also feel that, you know, these other guys that, you know, they couldn't stand up and say what this really was. And that's sad. I mean, I find that really sad. And
Do you think they're going to get away with it? If you're frustrated, I'm even more frustrated that they will get away with it. And I think a lot of the blame is the way our press operates, is that they simply are incapable of criticizing one party They have to find a way to say on the one hand and on the other hand. So they can't basically say this is actually a problem with the Republican Party. They have to say, well, you know, the Democrats. I mean, it's pathetic that this that they that we have this Tweedledum and Tweedledee binary kind of convention. But that is that what's stopping us from having a real national debate upon upon what's happening here and who's at fault, and they better own it and fix it?
Well, yeah, but you've got another megaphone out there that's basically saying, you know, and whether it's the blogosphere, you know, on the conservative side, or whether it's, you know, Fox News or others who just are not going to accept the fact that this is their problem. I mean, that this isn't something that is, you know, we'll have it. Okay, the Republicans have this issue, but you got to remember that a lot of this grew out of the Democratic South, you know, and so then they start to fudge and, you know, throw up a lot of smoke and mirrors, you know, around it. And then it's like you said, it's this binary. It's, you know, on the one hand, you got this, on the other, it's got that, as if it's an equal thing. It isn't. You know, it just isn't. But there is that false equivalence that is presented.
Well, just in closing, do you think that these moves, these calls to get rid of the flag, it's all, you know, the Confederate flag is a part of the flag of Mississippi. So that would require the state of Mississippi changing its flag. There's some talk that this is going to happen, but if that does happen, it still, to me, doesn't address what we've been talking about. And I have a feeling that just getting rid of a flag is going to be considered a great victory, but calling the grand old party out, you know, with its storied history, starting with Abraham Lincoln, et cetera, that has become captured by the, you know, Southern racists and the Tea Party, that's something that we should be talking about, and not accepting a change, a flag coming down as the be all and end all.
No, and I think it gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, where, you know, this happened before in the 90s. And, you know, and there was this outcry, you know, oh, my God, you know, here we are. We're connected with this racist group. Let's, you know, stop this. We don't want anything to do with this group. And here we are, what, 15 years later, and we're talking about the same group, same kind of, you know, problems that the party is dealing with. And is that going to happen 15 years from now? I would hope not. But and maybe taking down the flags and changing the flags, and as I understand, the request was made to take the Jefferson Davis out of the capital of in Frankfort, Kentucky. You know, maybe those are the steps in the right direction to, you know, kind of to begin getting rid of the divisiveness that you had talked about. I mean, using that as a political ploy, and maybe, you know, this is going to get to a point where people are going to say, no more of this, you know.
Right.
And we, and maybe it starts with getting rid of the symbols. I hope so.
Well, James Corcoran, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Corcoran, who's a former journalist and now a professor in the Department of Communications at Simmons College. He has written extensively on domestic terrorism, including the award-winning book Bitter Harvest, The Birth of Paramilitary Terrorism in the Heartland. And he, along with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Morris Dees, wrote Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with a former U.S. trade negotiation about how the president went against his own party and had to rely on the Republicans to get the Trade Promotion Authority passed in the Senate.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain. for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ira Shapiro, a former international trade negotiator during the Clinton administration. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions. His latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
Oh, it's good to be back with you, Ian.
And now that the Senate has overcome the procedural vote of 60 to 37, which is the threshold for the filibuster, that means that the final passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the Senate is guaranteed because it only requires 51 votes. This, of course, is the arcane nature of the Senate of today, right? That, you know, you can't pass anything until you get over this extraordinary hill, right? Which they've managed to do, what, the bare minimum vote today.
Well, that 60-vote threshold has become almost universal for things that are important. Let me say, though, Ian, just to clarify, what would be passed here is the Trade Promotion Authority.
Sure.
Not the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
That Trade Promotion Authority, which is the negotiating authority for the president to proceed to finish the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and presumably other things in his trade agenda.
Right, and this is the Trade Promotion Authority without the Trade Adjustment Assistance, TAA. That's been stripped, right?
Well, no. Well,
separate, I should say, yeah.
It is. This one was only the Trade Promotion Authority. The Senate, of course, has already passed Trade Promotion Authority and Trade Adjustment Assistance. And I think there is no doubt that the president will only sign the legislation for Trade Promotion Authority if other pieces of the trade agenda, including Trade Adjustment Assistance and customs enforcement and some provisions strengthening enforcement for the steel industry and trade preference, basically the Africa trade preference agreement, all of those things will have to be part of the trade agenda.
So you think it's premature to suggest that the TPP is closer to becoming a reality?
Well, I think it is getting closer to the point where the president will be given the Trade Promotion Authority to try to complete the TPP. And as you know, and as many of your listeners know, the other nations have said, we're not going to be able to finish this negotiation unless we're assured that the president has the Trade Promotion Authority. Otherwise, we're afraid that Congress will pick the agreement apart. So they would not be comfortable making their final offers and closing the negotiation without Trade Promotion Authority. The other thing, though, of course, as you know and your audience may know, the House of Representatives has been a much more difficult fight than the Senate has. It has passed Trade Promotion Authority very narrowly, only after a fierce fight.
Well, the fierce fight, how much, though, is that political theater? In other words, the Democrats in the House rebuked the president, and they made their point, and they got their covered in the election because it's not popular with the grassroots and the left of the Democratic Party and with the unions in this country. But the president then has to turn to the Republicans to get it done. Those are the optics.
Well, I think to some extent that's absolutely true, in the sense that the president has had to work with the Republicans, and it's been an unusual experience to work with Senator McConnell and House Speaker Boehner. McConnell described the whole thing as an out-of-body experience because he's worked so little with the president on anything. But I don't think it can be dismissed as wholly as political theater. This has been a very fierce fight and very over an issue that is extraordinarily divisive in the Democratic Party. It's no fun for the president to go up against 80 to 90% of his own party. And there are a lot of scars that have been left. A lot of the House Democrats who voted for TPA and have been, you know, going against labor on this, they're coming under some significant pressure and in response from labor, because labor is so opposed.
And again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, former international trade negotiator during the Clinton administration. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions. And his latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. So given that the president is opposed by, you said, 80 to 90% of the Democrats, he nevertheless, they made their point, and he, according to what just happened in the Senate today, he got his bill passed, or at least it's heading that way. Why did he do it then? Why did he stick his neck out like this and end up having the Republicans save his bacon?
Well, I think it can only be explained by his view that this is in the national interest. There's no other explanation for it. When the president looked at what our economy needs going forward, he concluded that regional trade agreements, particularly this one, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is what served our economy best. And he concluded that because Asia is the most dynamic region economically in the world. That's where there are going to be hundreds of millions of new consumers there in the next 10 years, middle-class consumers. If we're not in Asia and part of the economic integration, then you're outside of it and you're disadvantaged going forward. And I believe that the president, believe me, the president didn't make his decision lightly. He knew how much opposition he would get from his party. He made the decision any president, Republican or Democratic, would have made.
But when you say there'll be millions of new middle-class Asian consumers, most of them will be in China, and China is not in this TPP.
China is not in this TPP, but there are hundreds of millions of consumers elsewhere in Asia. But the other thing, Ian, is that, and this is a very important point that the president made in the State of the Union and many people have made, this Trans-Pacific Partnership with Japan and 10 other countries is our rules-based alternative to what China is offering. China is peddling a form of state capitalism, which does not respect intellectual property, does not believe in an open internet, does not have any interest in labor and the environment. China's doing very well on their own, but their model for the future of Asia is not our model. We're offering something that is a competing model. If China chooses to liberalize in the next few years, we hope they'll join TPP. But otherwise, the rest of Asia at least knows that there are two options in terms of economic models. And the president, who said that we were going to rebalance toward Asia, without the TPP, we look like a pretty bad joke in Asia.
Well, but the Chinese offered up membership to an infrastructure bank, and many U.S. allies like Australia and others joined in spite of pressure from the U.S. Has the U.S. offered up anything similar to that, or is there anything in the TPP that
They haven't offered up something similar to the Asia Infrastructure Bank, but the TPP is an offer of economic integration and economic development that is worth considering. And the reason that it has become the biggest trade agreement in a long time, since the Uruguay round, is that Japan joined it. So we have the first and the third leading economies in the world. And if you look, you see other countries already lining up to join. Korea has already expressed its interest, and others as well. So, you know, I don't question the sincerity of the opponents. They really are opposed to this, and I understand it. But from my standpoint, China is our biggest economic challenge and our biggest trade problem. And if we were to kill the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it would be of a great loss for the U.S. and a boon for China.
So when Senator Bernie Sanders says it's a great day for the big money interests, not a great day for working families, that's at the heart of the objections that most people have, and I've talked to an awful lot of people on this who have been opposed to it. And what everybody keeps saying is that this is, one, it was done in secret. Two, it was almost entirely conducted by representatives of huge multinational corporations. And three, many have argued that this is really a not about trade, but about a giveaway to corporate power.
Well, you were kind, I guess, in leaving out the parts of my bio that said I was a U.S. trade negotiator.
No, that's why I'm talking to you. Because
I know. Yeah. On previous trade agreements.
Right.
I don't agree with most of that critique. I respect the people that have expressed that view, but the truth of the matter is I don't think they're right, basically. I simply don't, first of all, I certainly don't believe that this has been done in excessive secrecy. The number of consultations with Capitol Hill, advisory groups that include labor and public interest people, believe me, the NGOs that are opposed are extraordinarily knowledgeable about the issues that are involved. We have some of us have different views, but it's not excessive secrecy that's the problem. The second thing is, the things we can argue for a long time about what has changed the U.S. economy over a 40-year period. And certainly globalization and technology have had an effect. They've had an effect on our economy. They've had an effect everywhere. But the record shows that the countries with whom we have trade agreements, we actually have better trade balances, better trade relations than with the countries we don't. And again, those people who think, as I do, that China is the main problem, this is a response and an alternative. And I think, you know, I'm a great admirer of a number of the people who are opposed, and I regret that we've been on opposite sides of these trade issues, I was going to say since the Clinton presidency, but actually since the 1980s. It's been a long time now.
But when you say we're on opposite sides to the Chinese, and that...
Well, I was saying, at that point, I was saying we're on opposite sides of many of my progressive
Sure,
friends.
No, but I'm just getting back to the core argument
China,
here,
yeah.
Which is that you're saying that TPP is a way to compete with China, in effect. But
yeah.
On the other hand, how do you explain the trade deals with China? How do you explain Walmart's relationship with China? I mean, there's already an enormous amount of trade between the U.S. and China. The malls are full of Chinese stuff.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's no doubt that while many people, and I don't just mean many U.S. companies, I mean many people in the government, many people around the country have hoped for a positive, hope for a positive relationship with China. It's too big a country to have anything else but work for a positive relationship. We have to recognize that things haven't gone that well on the economic or security sides recently. And so as a consequence, you see U.S. companies that are increasingly disillusioned with their experience in China. A lot of them are rethinking what they're doing in China. The point is, going forward, are we better off? You know, if you look at the Asia-Pacific region as extremely dynamic and integrating economically, the question is, are we better off inside that economic integration or outside it? And I think we're better off inside it, offering an alternative to China.
Well, you know, given that the Chinese just stole millions of, I mean, they literally went to the Office of Personnel Management, broke into their computers, and this is the office that clears all of the intelligence offices in the United States, alphabet soup of intelligence. So the Chinese have all the entire personal files of every American spy. I mean, they have been pulling off some pretty brazen things. Will the TPP in any way curtail that? I mean, if this is supposed to be an instrument that's going to stop Chinese bad behavior, how's it going to do it?
Well, I don't think the TPP alone would stop that kind of behavior. But defeating the TPP, saying that the 6 years we've spent on the negotiations with 11 other countries were the wrong thing to do, and that we should now walk away from it, I think all that would do would make us look like a joke, basically. If you turn on your friends and walk away from something at this stage of the game. And I don't, Ian, although I know members of Congress would say that they haven't been adequately consulted, I don't agree with that. I think every time a new entrant has come into the TPP, there's been a 90-day period before that new entrant, before we've approved their entry. That's when Congress could have done something about it. And the last thing I would say is, and I certainly Public Citizen has already said today, if the TPA fight is over, then they plan to fight against TPP when it comes back to Congress. And they say that, now I guess they say that because they think they know what's in it, although they've said they don't. But I would say that when the final negotiation is done and people look at it, they will find this to be a much more valuable and progressive trade agreement than they've expected.
Well, just in closing then, there is a question of constitutionality, and I don't know whether it will result in any kind of court challenge over the private arbitration tribunals that operate outside of a government's court system, which allow foreign investors to bring claims for money damages over violation to investor protection provisions. So do you think that's going to be challenged, the idea that there's something that transcends our justice system?
I don't think it's going to be challenged, but it certainly has been a lightning rod of concern. And as far as I'm concerned, I understand some of those concerns, and I could see where people worry about the suits that have been brought, although we've never lost any of them. But it is not the provision of the law that I find to be the most, it's not the thing that I like best in the agreement, because it produces more fear than it should. And it also produces long, tedious litigation, which ultimately we end up winning. But it's not something that is necessarily as valuable as some of the proponents say.
Right. Well, you wonder, why is it in there then?
Well, it's in there. It's actually in there because there are countries that have judicial systems that are not as well developed as ours. And investments do get expropriated or mistreated. And you need some alternative to the court systems of those other countries. in our country, you don't need an alternative to the court system because our court system works. It's also in there because, as an example, China's courts don't always adjudicate things as well as they should. And so if your investment is somehow mistreated in China, you'd like to have an alternative way to pursue it and protect it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ira Shapiro.
Ian, thanks. You're always good to give, to get into this in so much depth. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And we've been speaking with Ira Shapiro, former international trade negotiator during the Clinton administration. He spent 12 years in the United States Senators Council to the Majority Leader and other senior positions where he played important roles. And his latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Dominican Republic's threatening to deport its Haitian population born in the country. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Concannon, the Executive Director and Founder of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Previously, he co-managed the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux in Haiti and worked for the United Nations as a human rights officer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Concannon.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ian.
And the fact that the Dominican Republic is threatening to deport its Haitian population, which includes people that are born there, and apparently all Haitians that have been born in the Dominican Republic going back to 1923 have no citizenship rights. So these are very vulnerable people, effectively stateless people that the country is now threatening to deport en masse.
Yes, many of them did have citizenship rights. What has happened is that the Dominican Constitution has been changed and then retroactively applied. Like the U.S. and the Dominican Republic, if people are born there, then they're entitled to citizenship. There was always a small exception for children of diplomats and people in transit. That was never considered to apply to Haitians. But then in 2010, they changed the Constitution to say that to exclude not only people born to diplomats, but also people born to undocumented migrant workers. And then the Constitutional Court in 2013 retroactively applied that amendment back to 1929. So you actually have people whose great-grandparents were born in the Dominican Republic, and the grandparents and parents, none of those people have ever left the DR, but they're being expelled for not being Dominican citizens.
And hasn't also the government demanded that everybody in the country of Haitian descent register as undocumented workers, register their presence?
Deadline was
last week, wasn't it?
Exactly. So what happened when the Dominican government came under substantial international pressure when back in 2013 when that court decision came out retroactively applying, and it said, okay, we're going to pass this law that's going to soften the impact of that. But among the things they required people to do is to register. Many Haitians have registered. I think there's 275,000 by the government's report have registered in some form, but many are not willing to register because they're afraid that that registration information is just going to be used to deport them. Or a lot of people are saying, I'm not going to register as a foreigner. My grandfather and my father and my grandmother and mother were all born in the Dominican Republic. I'm Dominican. I'm not going to register as a foreigner.
So what's happening then with the Dominican government supposedly setting up these, what in effect are seven concentration camps? They're called shelters where Dominicans suspected of being of Haitian descent will be housed until a final evaluation is made?
Well, they've already started the deportation. The Dominican Republic had announced a year ago that it was going to do a moratorium on deportations as this process was working itself out, but they didn't hold to that. There were people being deported by the dozens a day throughout this year. But since last Wednesday, when the deadline for people, for migrant workers to register expired, they've been increasing that. There's been some different reports. It's certainly by the dozens a day. There was one report that just came out today that in central Haiti, which is the most remote border crossing, it's been 500 a day. So it looks like a fairly substantial amount, although certainly not 200,000 are being pushed across the border. There are also many Haitians who are leaving on their somewhat voluntarily, in the sense they're not being bussed out, but they're leaving because they're afraid they're going to get kicked out and not be allowed to take their possessions. And there also has been a campaign of attacks against Haitians, and they're afraid of violence.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Concannon, the executive director and founder of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Previously, he co-managed the Bureau des Affaires Internationaux in Haiti and worked for the United Nations as a human rights officer. Well, just what you've told us so far is pretty alarming. I haven't heard anything like this in terms of delegitimizing citizens. You know, you have to go back to what Nazi Germany in the 30s.
I think that is the most recent precedent where that large group of people have been delegitimized, and it's basically for racial reasons. And there's a lot of it is due to some of the political debates going on in the Dominican Republic, where politicians find it in their interest to kind of to increase anti-immigrant discourse. And it doesn't make sense economically in the same way that the United States is dependent on immigrants to do a lot of the work in our country. The Dominican Republic, their sugar plantations wouldn't work, their hospitality industry, their construction industry would really be ground to a halt if all the people of Haitian descent were removed from the country.
Yeah, but back in 1937, the Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo, didn't he instigate massacres in which thousands of Haitians were murdered?
Yes, ironically, the river across which many people are being sent across is called the Massacre River, in remembrance of that massacre, those kinds of not exactly massacres, but there's been regular killings over the last few years of Haitians, where most of the time it looks like it's some kind of a mob killing by Dominicans and a hate crime, and they're typically not investigated, and there's very few arrests made in those cases. But we haven't gotten back to the killing by the thousands as there was in 1937.
So, but what is the divide? This is ethnic between black Haitians and Hispanic Dominicans?
It's a little bit ethnic. It's also racial. Although most Dominicans would be considered black in the United States, they tend to be a little bit lighter than the average Haitians, and so there's a lot of racial animus in this discourse, and you're actually getting reports of people, of Dominicans, who say they have no Haitian blood, that you know they don't have any ancestors that came over from Haiti, but just because they're dark-skinned, they're being rounded up as Haitians and put on those buses. So in many ways, skin color is what is being used to identify people. Because a lot of the people, especially the ones that are the grandchildren of people, of immigrants, they no longer speak Creole. They have less of a cultural and linguistic identification with Haitians, and they're really Dominican. So it's hard to tell them apart other than skin color.
But isn't the Dominican Republic, compared to Haiti, infinitely better off? I mean, its environment hasn't been stripped and denuded. Its forests, they still have some forests. It still has operating infrastructure. I don't know what the comparison the GDP is, but I bet there's a considerable comparison between the two countries.
Yes, there is still significant poverty in the Dominican Republic, but not nearly in Haiti. I believe it's the per capita GDP is 5 or 6 times higher, and the infrastructure is better. It's about the same population on each side of the island, but the Dominican Republic has twice as much land, so there's much less pressure on the resources and much more development. So you're not doing cutting down trees for cooking, the Dominican Republic is. People are fleeing Haiti every day to go to the Dominican Republic because conditions there are, in fact, better than they are in Haiti, which is obviously a big problem for those people being deported. It's an individual problem, but it's also a collective problem because Haiti just doesn't have the resources to absorb people by the thousands.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I said, how could a country that's in such a fragile state, and it's been beset by political turmoil for decades now, and survived a massive earthquake, which a lot of reports suggest that all that aid sort of hasn't manifested in any way, even though I think the presidential palace is still in ruins. So the idea that this country that's so badly off would suddenly be a dumping ground for hundreds of thousands of its own citizens who were born next door and aren't even, never even been in the country, suddenly get, thrown into the play, into this situation, as if Haiti doesn't already have enough problems.
Yeah, it will be a burden on the people deported. Many of them don't speak Haitian Creole or don't have the skills needed to get by in Haitian society. It's going to be a burden on neighborhoods and families. There's already have been reports of cities and neighborhoods which have been passing the hat to try to help out people coming over, but that when the hat gets passed around too many times, there's nothing left to put in. So there's a lot of misery being inflicted on the Haitians who are forced to do their best to welcome these people. There will also be a stress on the government, although it's hard to tell exactly what that will be because the government hasn't announced any clear plans on what they're going to do. There's a sign up there for a welcome center, but it's out in the middle of this barren land with no buildings that's just starting to be cleared by bulldozers. So it's not really clear what the impact will be on the government, simply because the government hasn't listed any details.
But isn't this government a bit of a joke? I mean, the singer that's the president, he got elected with, 12% of the vote? I mean, I've never understood, and I know you spent a lot of time down there, and we spoke a lot during and after the earthquake, that why the U.S. has prevented the Haitians from having real democracy. It just seems to be this obsession about Aristide. I mean, I'm correct in saying that Martelly doesn't really have any kind of a mandate, does he?
You're correct that he is. He did not get enough votes in the first round to get to the second round, and it was basically Secretary Clinton who forced the Electoral Council to change some of the numbers in the first round when he ran in 2010. And it never would have been close if the Electoral Council had allowed Famille Lavalas, which is the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to run. So President Martelly doesn't have much of a constituency. He's at the tail end of his term. It's been a very unpopular term. There's been pretty consistent allegations of corruption and mismanagement and taking of political prisoners. So he doesn't have a real long-term perspective in this, and that may be why the government isn't responding to these deportations. Another reason why the government might not be responding, at least publicly, is that President Martelly's campaign was funded by a Dominican senator and some Dominican construction groups, many of which had very lucrative reconstruction contracts in Haiti. And so there's lots of connections between the president and political elites in the Dominican Republic that may be limiting his leadership on this.
But why did Hillary Clinton meddle, which is not, it's not so much her, it's just that's the continuum of U.S. foreign policy. For the life of me, I don't understand it. Why do we don't want, a majority rule there or real democracy? What's the problem?
There was a U.S. embassy in Haiti memo that was leaked by WikiLeaks, a cable, a few months before the 2010 elections. And the ambassador was giving an analysis of the then President Préval, who was in office. And it admitted that President Préval and his party were trying to manipulate the elections. But it concluded saying that the U.S. should continue to support him, basically because President Préval was willing to take directions from the U.S. government and implement policies that the U.S. government felt it should. And I think we just, we as a country, we tend to be fixated on people doing what we want them to do and not having the faith in democracy that we need to say, well, let the Haitian voters vote who they want. It might not be who we'd vote for, but we need to respect that. We need to respect their right to vote.
Well, nobody can say that our meddling has been successful and has advanced the lives of the Haitian people and the welfare of the country.
Yeah, I think especially if you go back even further through some of the dictatorships, including the Duvalier dictatorship that we supported, there's a significant body of evidence that our meddling is not helping anybody. And not only not the Haitians, but it's not helping the United States. We've had several very expensive military interventions. We spent a lot of money dealing with refugee outflows. There's lots of burden imposed on the American taxpayer because of misguided policies that don't allow democracy in Haiti.
Well, now on top of all of this, the country next door is dumping its Haitian-born, its native-born Haitians.
Yes, and that is a big burden. And I've been hearing some reports, and there's nothing really clear yet. But there's reports that could even be politically disruptive. That may put Haitians over the brink and lead to widespread civil unrest when they're stuck with this problem. They're feeling they're not getting any leadership from their government, and they're getting poor enough that they feel they have nothing to do other than to engage to fight for some very rapid change.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Brian Kincannon.
Well, thank you for covering Haiti.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.